The fall, our daughter started in preschool at age 2.5. One of her preschool teachers died. It happened quite suddenly. He hadn't been sick or anything, not that we knew of. He just didn't come into work one day. The whole school was stunned. The director brought in a grief counselor. I remember her conversation with the parents. She told us that this was an opportunity to teach our kids about death, to show them what we do when someone we care about dies. She told us not to hide our own feelings from our kids. Let them see that you are sad or shocked or even angry. That's all a natural part of grieving. She added one caveat that brought me up short. Let them see all of your feelings, she said, except fear. If you are afraid of death, get over it, work it out. Because if you are afraid of death, whether or not you mean to, you will teach your kids to fear death. Yikes. Thus began my examination of my own fear of death. Before I go on, I need to specify my parameters. Death and dying is a pretty broad topic for a 20-minute sermon. For simplification's sake, I am primarily going to focus on handling the anticipation of our own deaths. How we handle the death of a loved one is another topic. That would be a sermon on grief and loss. So, contemplating our own death. Here we go. I remember when I was a teenager touring Paris with my family, we included in our tour an exploration of the catacombs, those underground tunnels lined with piles of human bones, little walls built with femurs and skulls, arm bones and ribs and whatnot piled up behind. I found it a bit creepy, but my stepfather found it comforting. No matter what happens in life, we all end up the same in death, he said. We are born, we live, we die. After the admonition from the grief counselor at our daughter's preschool, I tried to carry and convey that matter-of-fact view of death when talking with our daughter, Athena. I would say things like, a life is a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. When a person or animal dies, its body stops working. The life is no longer there. The body is like an empty shell. When a person dies, the people who loved that person are sometimes sad because they miss the person who died. At a memorial service, people gather and help each other feel better by sharing memories and talking about what they loved about the person who died. I followed the advice they give parents on these matters. Let your kids know you are open to talking about it. Answer the kids' questions openly and honestly. Let them take the lead. Just answer the questions they ask. Don't tell them more than they are ready to hear. I found that the more I practiced talking to Athena about death in a matter-of-fact way, the more I actually felt more matter-of-fact about death. Just a natural part of life, nothing to be afraid of. I think it's partly that Western taboo on talking about death that intensifies our discomfort and fear. The more we talk about it, though, the more comfortable we become. For the most part, the transmission of this matter-of-fact attitude about death seemed to be a success. On walks, our daughter would talk about and inspect dead bugs, birds, and worms with a matter-of-fact curiosity befitting a scientist. When our daughter went through a phase of being interested in famous composers, she went through her book of composers, which specified birth and death dates, asking us to calculate how old each one was when they died. She was most interested in who was the oldest and who was the youngest. For your information, Verdi lived to be 88. Schubert died at 31. There were two incidents during which our daughter showed distress about death when she was somewhere around 3 years old. There was one unfortunate situation in which I killed a mosquito right in front of her, and she, much in need of a nap at the time, promptly burst out into tears. I felt guilty about that for weeks. Mom the murderer. Great. There was one other time, again when she was tired, that our daughter had that existential, I don't want to die breakdown that every parent fears. In my panic to protect her from all distress, I'm afraid I wasn't very effective. I don't remember what I actually said, mostly assurances of things I hoped would be true, that she wouldn't die for a long, long time, and by then the thought of dying wouldn't upset her so much. I cringe to recall my blunders. I may not have been demonstrating a fear of death, but I wonder if she picked up on my fear of her fear and her sadness. Perhaps I shouldn't have tried so hard to talk her out of it. There's a balance point there between providing comfort without trying to stop someone from feeling what they are feeling. In retrospect, though, I realized that more than what I said, the best comfort I could give her was what I did, holding her through her sadness. They say that one of the most important things to tell a kid when someone they love dies, or when they are afraid a parent might die, is you will always have people who love you to take care of you. By holding a kid through their sadness, you are demonstrating that this is what we humans can do for one another in the face of death, sadness, and fear. We hold one another in love. Having to introduce the concept of death and dying to our child, coupled with the caution from the grief counselor, caused me to launch into a more in-depth analysis of my feelings about death, specifically my fears about death. You may want to consider this question for yourself. Do you fear death? If so, why? Or why not? As I catalog the various aspects of this fear, think about which ones you share and which ones you don't. And talk about it. These fears of death can get more intense when we bottle them up. Let's not sanction that taboo here. Feel free to talk with one another. What did I say just two paragraphs ago? This is what we humans can do for one another in the face of sadness, death, or fear. We hold one another in love. Okay. Onward, notice which fears you share and which you don't. A common fear of death is rooted in a fear of an unpleasant afterlife, hell or purgatory or some such. Most Unitarian Universalists don't worry much about that one. Our theories about the afterlife are all over the map, but not many of us consider hell or purgatory a likely scenario. Though I wonder if those of you who were raised in a more orthodox religion carry a lingering, visceral fear about a fiery damnation despite your rational thinking. Another common fear of death is rooted in a fear of the unknown. None of us know for sure what happens after death. Going on a no-return trip to an unknown destination frightens some people. In general, I am not a fan of the unknown. I like to know what the plan is so I can prepare for it accordingly. Thus, it is somewhat surprising that though I do sometimes fear the unknown in life, I actually do not fear the unknown in death. I think that is because I believe that whatever happens after death, It is unlikely that my consciousness as I know it, attached to my particular personality, will remain intact. Whether my spirit or my energy will join with that great cosmic ball of spirit or energy, or whether I will just cease to be, it seems improbable that I, as I know I to be, will be aware of it. Of course, I could be wrong. If I end up as a ghost, I will probably be annoyed at the hubris of my living certainty. At any rate, for now, fear of the unknown in death isn't a fear that bothers me. Some people's fear of death is rooted in their fear of ceasing to be. The thought of being alive and then not, the thought of vanishing, is frightening. I think I've managed to sidestep that fear as well. Ceasing to be doesn't sound so bad to me. Sure, life has its pleasures, but life also has a lot of hard stuff. Being released from all that hard stuff could be kind of freeing. And again, since I'm doubtful that the consciousness of my own personality will remain intact after death, I'm guessing that I probably won't really be aware that I have ceased to exist, so it won't really matter to me. I was talking with my mom about this. As many of you know, my mother has cancer. The 40% chance of cure statistic she was given has prompted some conversation about death. My mother was saying she doesn't fear not existing, but the thought of not existing makes her sad. She likes being able to go for walks in the fresh snow or crunchy autumn leaves. She likes a good cup of coffee and a crossword puzzle, the little pleasures. The thought of dying makes her sad because she likes life. I get that. I'm not so attached to those visceral pleasures of life, and simultaneously escaping life's suffering seems to be a good trade-off. But I do feel sad when I think about losing my living relationship with people I love. So I suppose I am sad about ceasing to be, but I don't fear it. So far, the fears we've discussed have all been fears about what happens after you die. Fear of an unpleasant afterlife, fear of the unknown, fear of ceasing to be. Another common fear is fear of the dying process. Different people have different concerns here. Some are afraid of loss of dignity or autonomy. Some are afraid of becoming a burden on others. Some are afraid of the pain that might come with dying. This might be particularly scary for those who have witnessed a painful death. It may not be a concern for all of those who have witnessed peaceful deaths. When I think of my own fear of pain in dying, I wonder how or why it seems stronger than my fear of pain in living. If I can get through the pain of childbirth or surgery, why am I so afraid of whatever pain or discomfort may attend dying? What's the difference? Another fear in this category, one I felt from time to time, is fear of dying alone. Both the fear of dying when there's no one else in the room and the fear of the fact that even if someone is holding your hand, you ultimately make that shift from living consciousness to death on your own. But when I thought about it, it seemed that fear of dying alone is really a corollary to the other fears. If I was not afraid of dying, really not at all afraid of dying, then I don't think I would be afraid of dying alone, just like I'm not afraid of falling asleep alone. Perhaps the fear of dying alone is a kind of a foil for some of my other fears of death, fear of suffering, maybe. When I am struggling with something, be it physical pain or an emotional struggle, I do find it comforting to have loved ones around me. They don't have to be physically present, though, for me to feel their presence. I don't know what happens to people after they die, but I do feel that every person who has touched my life lives on in me in a very real, nearly tangible way. I have been shaped by my relationships with each of them. They make me who I am. It's a part of my theology, really. We are all a part of this interconnected web of life. I carry people I love around with me in my mind or heart or spirit. I feel them with me. Whether they are far away or dead or just not in the room, I feel them. And I imagine I will have them all with me in that way through my own dying and death. When I recenter myself in this knowledge, my fear of dying alone abates a bit. The fear I feel most strongly when I contemplate my own death is a fear for the well-being of those I love that are left behind. I get so heartsick when I hear about parents who die when their kids are only 3 or 10 or 15. I suppose anyone who has young kids worries about that. We want to stay alive long enough to launch our kids into their independence. Although I know a mother who says that it doesn't stop when your kid leaves home. She told me, "I used to think I would have to stay alive until my daughter went to university. Then she wouldn't need me as much, and I didn't have to worry so much about dying. But the day my kid turned 18, I realized, shoot, I'm not off the hook yet." Parents of disabled kids have a particularly hard time. My 27-year-old autistic half-brother still lives with his parents. My half-sister is set up to take care of him eventually, but I know my dad and stepmother worry about him. People worry about their spouses, too. How will their surviving partner manage when the partner dies who always took care of the cars or the banking or the cooking? Even when we know our kids or our partners can take care of themselves just fine, even when we've lived a long life, we may worry about how the people we love will endure the grief. So there's fear of the dying process, which is largely fear of our own suffering, and there's fear that our death will cause those we love to suffer. There are some things we can do to minimize both kinds of suffering in the future. Some of you may have noticed that we are hosting a workshop on February 4th called "What is a Good Death?" The workshop leader, Dr. Betty Donaldson, will invite participants to think about deaths that they have witnessed and then to ask questions like, which deaths would you consider good deaths and why? What, in your estimation, makes a good death? It's worth pondering, I think. We're all going to die, so what can you do now to make your death as pleasant as possible? There are several practical things you can do, setting up healthcare instructions, getting legal documents that provide for and protect your loved ones, and so on. In addition to Betty's workshop, we also have workshops coming up that will help you to navigate power of attorney issues and planned giving. And we're looking into hosting a workshop on green burials and other post-mortem options as well. There's the practical kind of preparation. Having a good death also requires two other kinds of preparation: tending relationships and tending your soul. Let's look at relationships first. In my years of ministry, I have seen a number of families navigate their way through the death of a loved one. Some do it gracefully, some struggle more. What I am reminded each time I witness it is that death intensifies everything. If a person has been a force of love through their life, then that love comes back manifold and holds them in their death. Love is often experienced and expressed as sorrow, but it is still love. Remember those words of Khalil Gibran, "When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight." When death comes, whatever is loving in a relationship can intensify in love. Likewise, whatever is difficult in relationship can intensify in difficulty. Feelings of disappointment, jealousy, betrayal, anger, old grudges can all come to the fore. When I talk to families that have a family member who knows their death is imminent, I sometimes suggest that they think about what they would like to say to one another and say it soon, before consciousness is blurred, before death comes. Say what you need to say, words of appreciation and gratitude, words of apology, words of forgiveness. Don't wait. Say it now. Of course, not all of us will get advance notice. Some deaths come more swiftly, which makes it all the more important to tend to our relationships now. It's an interesting thing to ponder. If I died today, would I be okay with the state in which I left each of my relationships? Do my friends know how much I appreciate them? Is there any complication I should straighten out? Are there any grudges I feel that I need to get over or work through? Do the people I love know how much I love them? There's a sentence in a passage by Philip Roth that comes to mind. In Patrimony, he writes about being at the hospital deathbed of his father. Quote, "Dying is work, and my father was a worker. I held his hand, which at least still felt like his hand. I stroked his forehead, which at least still looked like his forehead. And I said to him all sorts of things that he could no longer register. Luckily, there wasn't anything I told him that morning that he didn't already know." I suppose that would be my wish, when I die or when my loved ones die, that everything that needs to be said has already been said, is already known. That's about tending relationships. I also mentioned tending your soul. Contemplating your own death makes you contemplate your own life at a deeper level. It prompts you to think about questions like, what makes your life meaningful? There's that reading we ministers like to quote, the one by Reverend Victoria Safford. She writes of strolling through a cemetery and coming across an epitaph that read, "She attended well and faithfully to a few worthy things." Safford continues, "At first this seemed to me a little meager, a little stingy on the part of her survivors. But I wrote it down and have thought about it since, and now I can't imagine a more proud or satisfying legacy. Every day," she writes, "I stand in danger of being struck by lightning and having the obituary in the local paper say, for all the world to see, 'She attended frantically and ineffectually to a great many unimportant, meaningless details.'" She continues, "How do you want your obituary to read? He got all the dishes washed and dried before playing with his children in the evening. She answered all her calls, all her email, all her voicemail, but along the way she forgot to answer the call to service and compassion and forgiveness, first and foremost of herself." End quote. What do you want your epitaph to be? How do you want to live? For many of us, when we consider how we want to live and measure that up against how we are actually living, The contrast between the two beckons us to spiritual practice. Whatever kind of spiritual practice helps you to ground yourself in and live out of your best, most loving self, calm, centered, generous, compassionate. What helps you live as your best self? Walking in nature once a day, beginning the morning with prayer, ending the evening with gratitude journaling, singing about breathing in peace and breathing out love? How do you center yourself in the you that you want to be, in the life that you want to live? I recently gave my mother a set of guided meditations for cancer patients by Belarus Naparstek. The meditations are good for fighting cancer, but they are also good for general spiritual and physical wellness. They help you relax, help you resist going down the rabbit hole of worry, help you envision being held in a light of love, help you ground yourself in a deep sense of peace. It strikes me that these meditations, and really any spiritual practice, can help you handle both the hard stuff of life and the hard stuff of death. It's funny, when I put in your order of service announcements that list of workshops and seminars that we are offering in February, I initially thought I'd just include the ones that were directly relevant to this sermon: Good Death, Power of Attorney, Planned Giving, and its predecessor, Aligning Your Money with Your Values. There were two other courses, also starting in February. I didn't think they fit with our death and dying theme, but I decided it would be good to give them press anyway. Now it seems they have jumped right in with our theme. You can tend to your relationships by taking the Spiritual Practice of Relationships course, and you can tend to your soul by taking the Awakening Joy course. We are better planners than we know. This is my summary, then, supplemented with follow-up workshop opportunities. How do you prepare for a good death? Identify, work with, and talk about your fears. Do whatever practical planning you can to minimize suffering and allay those fears. Tend to relationships and tend to your soul. As we take this journey together, whether we encounter sorrow, fear, or death itself, may we all hold one another in love. So may it be. Amen.